at the site, but the tour schedule didn't permit it, and we grudgingly made our way to join the others. After lunch, we headed back to our hotel in Cusco and arrived just after dark. One of the lecturers on the tour called our room and told us to come over. When we arrived, we saw what he'd ordered from a local restaurant. Roasted guinea pig. "Come on," he said. "Let's try it. I had one of the guides order it from a local restaurant. We'll get pictures." Looking at it made me feel suddenly queasy. I leaned toward Micah. "It still has the head and the claws." Micah shrugged. "It is supposed to be a delicacy. And besides, the painting shows that it's what they served at the Last Supper." "You're not really thinking of eating it, are you?" "I might taste it. It's the only chance I'll get. It's not like they serve it where we live." "Really? You're going to take a bite?" "I think I have to. And do me a favor." "What's that?" "Get a picture for Allie." "That's mean. She's going to scream." "No, she won't. She'll think it's funny. And I'll get a picture of you taking a bite, too." "Me?" "Of course. I can't let you throw away a moment like this. Like they say, when in Rome." I looked at the guinea pig again. It makes me a little nauseated to even consider it. "That's why I'm here, to help you experience new things, to make you stretch." "Gee, thanks." "Hey," he said, shrugging. "What are brothers for? Now get the camera ready." I did and snapped the picture as he took a bite. He did the same for me when I took a small bite, my stomach churning like a lava lamp on amphetamines. "Now that wasn't so bad, was it?" "I think I'm going to throw up," I admitted. He laughed before putting his arm over my shoulder. "Think of it this way. It's just the latest in a long line of stupid things that we've done. And this time, it wasn't even dangerous." During those first years in Fair Oaks, even as we began to test the limits of our courage through daredevil stunts, we continued to drift apart. Micah was spending more time with his friends, and I was spending time with mine. Occasionally, our friends would end up in the same place, but more often than not, they didn't. Still, there were certain rites of passage that we both underwent, albeit at different times. With the fields and woods in our neighborhood disappearing as new housing developments sprang up, we both began spending more time at the nearby American River. There were bike trails and places to skimboard, sort of like water skiing, only the board is larger and tied to a tree along the bank instead of a boat. The current keeps you upright. There was also a pedestrian bridge that spanned the river about 45 feet above the water, and it was an accepted ritual of childhood to jump from the bridge into the chilly water below. Land wrong and the breath would be knocked clean out of you. I first jumped from the bridge when I was 10. Micah had done it a year earlier. Later, I jumped from the fence atop the bridge, intended to keep jumpers from jumping, of course, which added another 10 feet to the jump. Micah had done that jump too, well before I did. Our favorite activity, however, was riding the rope swing, and we could spend hours at it. Tied to the center of the bridge, the rope was stretched taut and with a board fastened to it. We'd jump from the bridge with the board between our legs and clinging to the rope, feel the G-force as we swooped over the water at 80 miles an hour before swinging up toward the bridge again. It was dangerous and illegal, and frequently the sheriff arrived to confiscate our rope swing. As he did so, he'd eye me or my brother. "Don't I know you?" he'd sometimes ask. "I don't see how," we'd answer innocently. Micah and I also climbed the bluffs alongside the river. They were nearly vertical and the dirt unstable. Both of us slipped on more than one occasion, sometimes falling as much as 30 feet and nearly breaking our ankles and legs. Once I nearly lost a finger bluff climbing. The cut went clear to the bone of my knuckle. But my mom told me not to worry because she knew exactly what to do. She put a Band-Aid on it. But for the most part, Micah and I weren't doing these things together. If I went to the river occasionally, Micah went there almost daily. If I jumped from the bridge once, he would do it 10 times and find a way to increase the danger. "Let's ride our bikes off it." If I went over to a friend's house on Monday, Micah would be at a friend's each and every afternoon. Micah was simply more in everything, including the trouble he was beginning to cause. Though a relatively good student, he continued getting into arguments with teachers and fights with other students, and my parents were being called to the principal's office at least 3 times a year. I, on the other hand, spent year after year garnering perfect scores on exams and doing extra credit assignments, all the while hearing teachers remark, "You're so much easier than your brother was." And I read constantly, not only the encyclopedias and the Bible, but almanacs and atlases as well. I simply devoured them, and strangely, the information just seemed to stick. no matter how obscure or irrelevant. By the sixth grade, I was prodigious with trivia. If someone pointed to any country in the world, I could recite statistics, name the capital, tell you what the major exports were, or recite the average rainfall months after skimming the information. Still, it wasn't necessarily something that other kids my age found too impressive. A group of us might be standing around at recess, for instance, when one would say to one of the others, "Hey, how was your camping trip to Yosemite?" "Oh, it was great. Me and my dad pitched a tent and went fishing. Man, you should have seen how many fish we caught. And we saw the sequoias, too. Man, those are the biggest trees I've ever seen." "Did you hike around Half Dome?" another would ask. "No, but the next time we go, my dad says we can. He says it's supposed to be awesome." "It is. I did that last year with my dad. It was so cool." Meanwhile, noticing me standing quietly off to the side, someone might try to include me. "Hey, have you ever been to Yosemite, Nick?" "No, I haven't," I'd answer. "But did you know that even before it became a national park in 1890, the land was actually given in trust to the state of California in 1864 by the U.S. Congress and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln? You'd think that with the Civil War in full swing, he wouldn't have had time for something like that, but he did. And in the end, the use of land trusts set the stage for Yellowstone to become the first official national park in 1872. And did you know that Yosemite Falls, which are the fifth tallest in the world at 2,450 feet, is actually made of three separate falls? Or... My friend's eyes would glaze over as I went on and on. Yep, that was me, Mr. Popularity. My sister, too, was becoming her own person. Like me, she got along with her teachers, although her grades usually hovered around a C in nearly every class. Though my parents were both college graduates and viewed education as important, my mother had received her degree in elementary education and my father was a professor, neither seemed concerned about my sister's academic performance. They didn't push her to work harder, nor did they help her with her studies, nor did they mind if she brought home poor grades, the reason yet again being, she's a girl. They did, however, enroll her in horseback riding lessons, thinking a skill like that would serve her well in the long run. The more I excelled in school, the harder I tried to do even better, if only to stand out for my siblings. Somehow, I believed that my parents would then shower me with the attention I felt was given automatically to my brother and sister. If Micah got attention because he was the oldest and my sister got attention for being the only girl, I wanted recognition for something, anything. I yearned for moments when I could be the center of attention at the dinner table, but no matter what I did, it never seemed to be enough. While I never doubted that my parents loved me, I couldn't help but think that had my mother been given Sophie's choice, I would have been the one sacrificed to save the other two. It was a terrible thing to believe, and as a parent now I know that attention isn't the same as love, but the feeling wouldn't go away. Even worse, I began to notice those moments with ever-increasing acuity. In the fall, when it was time for new school clothes, I would get a couple of new items and Micah's hand-me-downs. Both Micah and Dana would receive far more than I did. And my mom, if she acknowledged my feelings at all, would simply shrug and say that Micah's clothes are new for you. As I grew older, both my parents seemed oblivious to how a child like me would view their actions. I'll never forget one Christmas when we woke up to find three bikes under the tree. Christmas was far and away the most exciting day of the year for us, because we seldom got anything we wanted the rest of the time. We would count down the days and talk endlessly about what we wanted. That particular year, bikes were on the top of the list. Bikes meant freedom. Bikes meant fun, and the ones we'd owned previously had become unusable through sheer wear and tear. When we crept out of the living room, the tree lights were glowing and we stared at our gifts with wonder. Micah's bike was new and shiny. Dana's bike was new and shiny. My bike was shiny. For a moment, I thought it was new as well. But then ever so slowly, I began to recognize it, despite the new paint job. Like a bad dream, I realized that my parents had given me my own bike, albeit a repaired one. Granted, it had cost money to repair, but still, it crushed me to think I was given a gift that I already owned, while Micah and Dana got new ones. When it came to grades, our parents used to post our report cards on the refrigerator, and I couldn't wait for my mom to get home so I could show her how well I'd done. When she saw my report card, she said that she was proud of me, but when I woke the following morning, I noticed that the report cards had been taken down and slipped into the drawer. When I asked my mom why, she said, "It hurts the other kids' feelings." After that, the report cards were never posted at all. Perhaps, only later did I come to realize Micah and Dana had their own insecurities as well. Despite these perceived childhood slights, I adored my mom. Then again, so did everyone who knew her, including all my friends and our dog Brandy. At night, Brandy, all 80 pounds of her, would crawl up and lie in my mom's lap as she sat reading in the living room. My mom's attitude made it hard not to like her. She was always upbeat, no matter how terrible things were, and she made light of things that most people would have found unbearable. For instance, my mom worked, as many mothers did, but she had to ride a bike to work. Whether it was pouring rain or 105 degrees, my mom would dress for work, hop on the bike, and start pedaling the 4 miles to the office. Her bike had a basket on the handlebars and two more behind the seat. After work, she'd ride the bike to the grocery store, load in whatever we needed, then ride home. And always, I mean always, she beamed when she walked in the door. No matter how hard the day had been, no matter how hot or wet she was, she made it seem as if she were the lucky one, and that her life couldn't get any better. "Hey, guys, it's great to see you. I can't tell you how much I missed you today." Then she'd visit with each of us, asking about our days. And one by one, Micah, Dana, and I would fill her in as she began cooking dinner. She was also a giggler. My mom could laugh at anything, which naturally drew people to her. She wasn't Pollyanna, but she seemed to realize that life had both ups and downs, and it wasn't worth the energy to get upset about the downs, since not only were they inevitable, but they'd pass as well. My mom also seemed to know everyone's parents, and when I'd met someone new, this new friend would frequently mention how much their mom liked visiting with my mom. This always struck me as a mystery because my mom had no social life. Almost all her evenings and weekends were spent at home with us, and she ate lunch alone. Nor, by the way, did my parents socialize together or even go out on what might be considered a date. In all my years growing up, I remember my parents going out to a party together only once, and it was downright shocking to us when they casually mentioned that they were going out for the evening. I was 13 at the time, and after they left, Micah, Dana, and I called a powwow to discuss the extraordinary turn of events. "They're leaving us on our own. What can they be thinking? We're just kids." Never mind that we were on our own every day. But who needs logic when you're feeling sorry for yourself? How then did people know her? It turned out that various parents of new friends were attended to by my mom at the optometrist's office and struck up conversations with her. But it wasn't simply idle talk. My mom had a way of getting people to open up to her. People told her everything. She was a veritable Ann Landers of Fair Oaks, and occasionally, when I mentioned a new friend, she'd shake her head and say something like, "It's fine if he comes here, but you can't go over there. I know what goes on in that house." Yet my mother was, and always will be, an enigma to me. While I knew she loved me, I couldn't help but wonder why she wouldn't acknowledge my successes. While we kids were the center of her life, she let us run wild in dangerous places doing dangerous things. These inconsistencies have always puzzled me, and even now I'm at a loss to explain them. I've long since given up trying to understand it, but if there was anything consistent in the way she raised us, it was in her refusal to allow any of us to indulge in self-pity of any kind. She achieved this through a maddening style of argument, in which the following three statements were repeated in various sequences. A. It's your life plus social commentary. B. What you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things. C. No one ever said that life was fair. For example, an argument I had with her when I was 11. "I want to go out for the football team," I said. "There's a Pop Warner League and all my friends are playing." "It's your life," she answered. "But I don't want to be responsible for your hobbling around on crutches your whole life because you blew out your knee as a kid. And besides, we don't have the money for it." "But I want to." "What you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things." "That's not fair. You always say that." She shrugged. "No one ever said that life was fair." I paused, trying another approach. "I won't get hurt if that's what you're worried about." She looked me over. "Someone your size? You'd definitely get hurt. I've seen football players. You'd be nothing more than a bug on the windshield to them. You're too small." She had a point there. I was small. "I wish I was bigger like my friends are." She put a consoling hand on my shoulder. "Oh, sweetie, no one ever said life was fair." "I know, but still." "Just remember this, okay?" She'd offer, her voice softening with maternal affection. "It'll help you later in life when you're disappointed about anything. What you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things." "Maybe you're right. Maybe I should try another sport." My mom would smile tenderly as if finally conceding the argument. "Hey, do what you want. It's your life." The older I got, the more I hated these arguments, because I lost every one of them. But still, deep down, I could never escape the feeling that my mom was probably right about most things. After all, she spoke from experience. Chapter 9, Easter Island, Chile, January 29th to 30th. As we looked out the airplane window, Easter Island slowly came into view, a remote and exotic sight that only underscored how far from familiar surroundings we were. Easter Island, like most islands in the South Pacific, was first settled by Polynesians. But because Easter Island was so far from the rest of populated Polynesia, nearly 2,200 miles from the coast of Chile, it's the remotest inhabited island in the world. The native people developed their own unique culture, which included the carving of giant statues known as the Moai. Of all the places listed in the original brochure, Easter Island had been the most intriguing to me. I'd read about the Moai and had longed to see and touch them ever since I was a child. Because it was so remote, I fully realized that this trip might be the only time I ever set foot on the island, and I craned my neck looking out the window as we circled in preparation for landing. What struck me immediately was the scarcity of trees. I suppose I'd imagined palms and rainforests typical throughout the South Pacific, but instead the island was largely covered with grassy meadows, as if part of Kansas had been dropped into the middle of the ocean. Later we'd find out from the archaeologists that the absence of trees partially explains the cultural history of Easter Island. But at the time I remember thinking how odd it seemed. Another interesting thing about Easter Island is the time zone in which it is located. Because we were flying west, we would cross time zones and lose a day on our way to Australia, but it enabled us to maximize our days. If we left at 10, for instance, and flew for 5 hours, we might arrive only 3 hours after we departed, as measured by local time. But because the island is part of Chile and thus shares the eastern time zone, along with New York and Miami, despite lying geographically west of California, we were told the sun wouldn't set until 10:45 p.m. Dinner was served outdoors, and afterward a few of the tour members strolled over to a seaside bluff to watch the sun go down. Waves crashed violently against the rocks, the plumes rising 40 to 50 feet in the air. In the west, the sky turned pink and orange, before finally changing into the brightest red I've ever seen. And then an impenetrable darkness descended. Micah and I were sitting together watching all of this when he finally turned to me. "I think I know what your problem is," he said. "What problem? Why you get so stressed all the time? Why do you keep talking to me about this? Here I am enjoying my first South Pacific sunset, and you want to start probing my psyche." "Your problem," he said, ignoring me, "is that you need more friends." "I have friends. I have a lot of friends." "Guy friends?" "Yeah. But do you do anything with them? Do you go out with them? Go fishing or boating or whatever it is you do down south?" "Sometimes." "Sometimes or rarely?" I hesitated. "Okay, so I don't do much with them. But I can't. To have the time to go out with friends, I'd have to give up time with my family. I have too many kids to do that. And besides, most of my friends have kids too. I'm not the only one who doesn't have a lot of free time to just hang out." "You should, though. Just hang out. Not all the time, of course, but you should try to make it more regular. Like I do. I joined an indoor soccer league and we play every Thursday. Just a group of guys out there having fun. You should do something like that." "We don't have an indoor soccer league. I live in a small town, remember?" "It doesn't have to be soccer. You can do anything. The point is that you should do something. Relationships are the most important thing in life, and friends are part of that." I smiled. "Why do I get the impression that you think the solution to all my problems is to be more like you?"
"Hey,
if the shoe fits," he shrugged, and I laughed. "So you think you have to take care of me, huh?" "Only when I think you need it, little brother."
"And what if I started talking to you about God, because I think you need it?"
"Go ahead," he said. "I'll listen." Above me, the sky was filled with stars clustered together in unrecognizable constellations. And the words rose up almost unexpectedly. "God keeps his promise, and he will not allow you to be tested beyond your power to remain firm. At the same time you are put to the test, he will give you the strength to endure it, and so provide you with a way out." Micah glanced over at me. Despite the darkness, I could see him raise his eyebrows. 1 Corinthians, I said, chapter 10.
"Impressive."
I shrugged. "I just always liked that verse. It reminds me of the footprint story. You know, the one where God walks with the man on the beach. Scenes from the man's life flash in the sky, and during flashbacks of the most trying times of the man's life, he sees only one set of footprints. Not because God abandoned the man in times of need,
but because God carried the man. Micah was quiet for a moment.
So you don't think he abandoned us?
No, I said. And I don't think he wants you to abandon him either. The following morning, we set off to see the first of the giant statues known as the Moai, which were located less than a few minutes from the hotel just up the coast. Had we known where we'd be going, we could have seen them from our hotel room. As we rode in the vans with the archaeologists who made their living studying them, we were informed that at one time there were roughly 14 different tribes on the island, each with its own ruler. These rulers ordered the carving of these statues from volcanic rock. Most were made to resemble said rulers, and over time these statues grew larger and larger, as each ruler tried to impress on the people his own importance. Some of the Moai weigh up to 30 tons and stand 12 feet high. One unfinished statue measures 66 feet and is estimated to weigh nearly 50 tons. Afterward, we were told about the absence of trees. When it was first colonized, Easter Island had resembled other islands in the Pacific. But as the population expanded, trees became the most overused of all the natural resources. They were employed in construction of dwellings and for cooking fires. Mature trees were used to roll the Moai across the island. In the past, when Polynesians migrated as islands became overcrowded, people would head off in their canoes in search of new territories. Because Easter Island was so isolated, there was nowhere else to go. Overcrowding and overuse of the resources led to civil wars. The wars continued through generations. Through it all, trees continued to be cut down. In the end, most had been wiped out, and the natives ended up burning anything they could in order to cook, including their homes and canoes. Shore fishing became the sole source of food. But a La Niña effect is suspected to have suddenly cooled the waters around the island. It lasted 2 years, killing much of the ocean reef, and the fish became much less plentiful. In the end, the natives turned to cannibalism. Over time, a few palms eventually sprouted again, but to speed the process, mature palms were imported from Tahiti. These trees, however, turned out to be diseased, and they not only died, but ended up killing most of the remaining palms on the island. Now there are only a few spots where they still remain. The first statue we saw was fascinating. So were the second and third. By the time we viewed the fourth and fifth statues, the novelty began to wear off. Though the local archaeologist assured us that each was different, to my untrained eye, they all looked pretty much the same. Eye sockets, long ears, nose, and mouth, all carved from lava rock. From there, we headed to the volcano quarry where they'd been carved. To reach it, you had to cross the island. And the distance these statues had been transported fascinated me more than the statues themselves. As we drove, I tried to imagine how many people it had taken to move a single statue, let alone hundreds. As we drove toward the quarry where the Moai had been carved, lush, open pastures unfolded on either side of us. Beyond the pastures, we could see herds of wild-looking horses loping along. Horses were a symbol of prosperity on Easter Island. They had been imported in the late 1800s. But because the island was so isolated, feed was prohibitively expensive to import. The owners allowed the horses to run free so they could forage on the island grass. Their muscles were lithe and their coats gleamed in the sunlight, inspiring Micah to take a photograph of them. The volcano rose 1,400 feet, and everywhere along the base you could see abandoned statues. Some lay on their side, others were half buried along a trail that progressed to the far side of the island. At the quarry itself, others stood in various stages of completion. Again, there was no answer as to the reason. There was speculation about the wars, but as with so many of the places we went, nothing was certain. For all intents and purposes, it looked as if the workers had left for the day with the full intention of returning on the next. A winding trail leads to the peak of the volcano, and about a third of our group eventually made their way to the summit. From the top, it's possible to see the curvature of the earth, and Micah and I were the first to reach it. Under blue, cloudless skies and with the temperatures in the 70s, the hike was refreshing. Surrounding the island was nothing but an endless expanse of water. And I wondered how the first Polynesians had ever survived in the open Pacific long enough to discover the island. At the top, we took pictures before sitting near the edge of a sheer drop-off. As we relaxed, Micah pulled up the picture he'd taken of the horses. He stared at it. "Mom would love this," Micah said. "She would have wanted to frame it." "Yes, she would," I said. "Dana, too." "Do you remember when we took those horseback riding lessons?" "Actually, I don't. You and Dana did that, remember?" "Yeah. Why didn't you ride with us?" "Because," I said, "there wasn't enough money and you two were more excited about it than I was." He put his arm around me. "The poor middle son, always feeling left out." I didn't feel left out. I was left out. No, you weren't. Mom and Dad were always proud of you. They used to tell me that I should do better in school, like you. That's why they took my report card down from the fridge, right? They didn't do that. Yes, they did. Really? Really. I don't remember that. You wouldn't. He laughed. Isn't it funny the way memory works? We remember different things. You know, the kinds of events that people lie on the couch and talk to their therapists about? I remember once I asked for a stereo and headphones for Christmas. Not a big one, just one for my room, you know? I must have been about 12 or so, and I begged for that thing. I must have hounded Mom for months about it. And on Christmas morning, I remember going out there and seeing it under the tree, headphones and the stereo. There was a card that said, "To Micah." I was so excited. It was the best gift I ever got. Then Mom comes out, and when I thanked her, she started saying, "No, no, no, just the headphones are yours. The stereo is for the family." I was crushed. I mean, it's the only thing I wanted. And besides, what good are headphones without a stereo? It's like getting a single shoe. Our parents were crazy sometimes, weren't they? Sometimes? Yeah, you could say that. I sat in silence for a few moments, musing on the past. Gradually, people began leaving the summit. The tour had a schedule to maintain. "Come on," I finally said. "Let's get going. We've got to see some more statues." When I looked at Micah, he seemed oddly contemplative. I suddenly knew he was thinking about the past as well. His eyes were focused on the horizon. "No, let's wait here for a couple more minutes," he said quietly. "Then we'll go." I looked toward the horizon, following my brother's gaze. "Okay." After descending the volcano, we journeyed to the single most photographed spot on Easter Island. Giant statues of the Moai, about 20 or so, stand together in a straight line along the coast. Until a few years ago, all had been toppled over, some broken into pieces. The archaeologists who joined us as guides had helped not only to repair them, but position them upright once more. These, I thought, were the statues that Jacob Roggeveen, a Dutch admiral, must have seen when he became the first European to discover the island on Easter Sunday, 1722. Legend has it that his first thought was that the island was inhabited by giants. Only when he drew nearer to shore did he realize that men of normal size were working among the statues. The statues, however, hadn't been completely restored. Originally, we learned, all the statues on the island had eyes. Carved from wood, they were painted with pupils, but it eventually decayed, leaving nothing but the sockets and giving the statues a skeletal appearance. "Why do you think they aren't going to put eyes in again?" Micah asked me. "They stood them upright, so it's not as if they believe the statues shouldn't be disturbed." "I have no idea. Maybe they think it would give tourists like us the willies." Micah stared toward the statues. "I wouldn't get the willies." "Neither would I." He paused. "I think they'd look better with eyes." "Me too." "Maybe we should start a movement. Call it Eyeballs for Statues. It has a nice ring to it. Go for it." He continued to stare. "I really do think they'd look better, don't you?" Standing next to Micah, I realized that there were times when we talked not because we needed to communicate anything important, but simply because we each drew comfort from the other's voice. After taking photographs, we got back in the van and headed to Anacana, a cove fronted by a white sand beach that was dotted with one of the few remaining groves of palm trees. For the first time, we saw a part of the island that looked tropical. An ancient Moai seemed to be standing guard at the head of the beach, watching over the bathers. After a barbecue on the beach, Micah and I and a few others went for a swim. By then, our group had begun breaking into cliques. Some folks were adventurous and wanted to experience everything they could. Others seemed to view the sights as inconveniences they had to endure between meals and cocktail parties. Some of this was age-related, some of it had to do with attitudes. Micah and I were part of the adventurous group. We always took the fast walker tours as opposed to the slow walker tours, and the chance to swim in the South Pacific wasn't something we were going to miss. Though a small thing, it would be another in a long line of first-time evers we would experience together. "They don't know what they're missing, do they?" Micah said to me as he pointed to the people sitting on the beach. "Maybe it's not a big deal to them. A lot of these people have traveled before." "Maybe," he said. "Or maybe they never did it in the past either. Some people just don't know how to have fun. They aren't even willing to try." I glanced warily at Micah, suddenly wondering if he was talking about me. In seventh grade, Micah went off to Barrett Junior High School, and we continued to grow apart. My sister and I, however, were growing even closer. She laughed all the time and had a quality of sweetness that almost made me feel guilty about the kind of person I was. She seldom got angry, and I sometimes overheard her talking to Mom about how proud she was of us. In her eyes, Micah and I could do no wrong. And whenever we were punished, my sister would be the one to come into our room and listen to us complain about the injustice of what our parents had done to us. My sister always seemed to know how I felt inside. She was the only one who understood that excelling in school had more to do with an inferiority complex than any particular love of school. She would sometimes ask me to help her with her schoolwork and use those opportunities to build my confidence. "I wish I was as smart as you," she'd say, or, "Mom and Dad are so happy with how well you're doing." Growing up, Dana was the only one of us who ever had a birthday party because, as my mom explained to us, she's a girl. This wouldn't have been so bad, neither Micah nor I ever clamored for a party. But because my sister and I shared the same birthday, it always felt a little odd to have to watch my sister having a party while I stood off to the side. If my mom didn't understand it, however, my sister did. And one year she came into my room early on the morning of our birthday and sat on the edge of my bed. Jostled awake, I asked her what she was doing. She began to sing, "Happy Birthday to You." Afterward, I sang the song back to her, and every year after that, it was our own secret ritual. We'd sing to each other, just the two of us, and we never told anyone about it. This was our secret, as it would be for years. And after singing to each other, we'd talk for a while. I'd tell her everything, my hopes and fears and struggles and successes, and Dana would do the same. When she was 12, I asked her, "What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want more than anything?" My sister looked around the room with a dreamy smile. "I want to be married, I want to have kids, and I want to own horses." She got this, I knew, from my mom. More than anything in the world, my mom always wanted a horse. Growing up, she'd owned a horse named Tempo, and she often spoke of the horse and the wonderful time she used to have riding. "That's it?" I asked. "That's it. That's all I want out of life. Don't you want to be rich or famous or do exciting things?" "No, that's for you and Micah." "But won't you be bored with that?" "No," she said with conviction, "I won't." My sister, I knew then, wasn't the complicated bundle of nerves that I was. When she finally left the room, I remember wishing that if I couldn't be like Micah, that I could be just like her instead. When I started at Barrett Junior High the following year, I joined Micah on the long bus ride to school, but we never sat together or even seemed to talk. Eighth graders occupied a completely different realm than did seventh graders. They were the big men on campus, and our paths seldom crossed in the hallways or at recess. After school and on weekends, Micah ran off to see his friends while I stayed to compete on various athletic teams. Though a good athlete, I wasn't extraordinary, and distinguished myself neither on the football field nor when I ran track and field. The following year, Micah started high school, and we were separated again, both during and after school. By then, I'd grown used to doing my own thing. Halfway through my eighth grade year in 1978, we moved to the first and only house my parents would ever own. We handled the move ourselves. Who needs to pay a moving company when there are a couple of strong boys and a Volkswagen van on hand? So day after day, we loaded everything from the house into the back of the van and hauled it to the new home. But Volkswagens aren't really designed for exceptionally heavy loads, and my brother and I didn't care how much we loaded into ours. We would fill the back of the van with my dad's books until there wasn't an inch to spare. It probably weighed half a ton, and the van was riding exceptionally low in the rear. Meanwhile, the nose of the vehicle actually pointed upward like someone eyeing a distant horizon. "We got it all loaded in, Mom." Mom stared at the van. "It looks crooked. It looks like it's just about to pop a wheelie." "That's just because it's heavy in the back. It'll straighten out when we unload it." "You think it's safe to drive?" she asked. Why she asked us, I'll never know. Neither Micah nor I even had our license. "Of course it's safe. Why wouldn't it be?" The good news was that the van made it to the new house. The bad news was that even after unloading all the books, the van didn't level out. At all. We'd crushed whatever support there had been in the rear. "Is the front still pointing toward the sky, or is it just me?" Mom finally asked. "Maybe we're looking at it crooked, or the street's not level." We tilted our heads, checking the van, looking up and down the road. "I think you broke something," Mom finally said. Nah, we said. It'll be fine. Give it time. It'll go back to normal.
Your dad's going to be mad.
He won't even notice, we reassured her. But even if he does, he won't care.
Of course my dad noticed, and the DEFCON countdown started after he got home, though we were smart enough to be long gone by then.
Thankfully, by the time we got home, he had calmed down, since the van seemed to run fine despite the crazy way it looked. And if it ran fine, that meant there was really no reason to fix it. That would be spending money we didn't have. So in the end, the van was never repaired, and for the next 3 years, until we traded it in for the new improved Volkswagen van, we drove around town looking as if we were hauling baby whales to the zoo. Our new house was small. A single-story ranch with a converted garage, it had 4 bedrooms, an office, a living room, and a kitchen. 2 of the rooms, the office and master bedroom, had been converted from the garage. The house was 25 years old and in dire need of repairs. Even with the garage conversion, it was less than 1,300 square feet. But to us, it was awesome. My brother, sister, and I each had our own room for the first time in our lives, and we all took time decorating them in our own style. My mom was tremendously proud to finally have a home she could call her own, and she spent much of the next few years fixing the place up and adding her own splashes of personality. There were 16 walls all painted in different colors. My mom changed wall paint more often than some people change their toothbrushes, and every weekend, Micah and I had to finish our mother's list before we could head off to play. We spent our Saturday mornings building fences, painting walls over and over, planting bushes and trees, sanding kitchen cabinets, and executing whatever plan she happened to come up with while at work. Because the family had little extra money to spend on such things, it was a slow process. To build the fence, for instance, my mom would buy 12 planks of wood every week, all she could spare from her paycheck. It took her nearly 5 months to accumulate all the wood we needed to build the fence, but thankfully, in her opinion anyway, the labor was free. Micah and I, no doubt drawing on our roofing experience in Nebraska, were put in charge of constructing the fence, and we did. That it ended up sloping noticeably, as opposed to being straight across the top, was simply one of the outcomes my brother and I assumed our mother had foreseen before deciding to delegate the project to us. Knowing we'd continue to do most of the work on the house, our parents began giving us tools for Christmas. It was a way of killing 2 birds with 1 stone. Not only did we get something unexpected, how could I expect to receive a hammer for Christmas if I didn't want one, but they would save money at the same time, and it was much better than offering us weapons again. Late one Christmas morning, I sat beside Micah on the couch. "What do you think of Christmas this year?" he asked. "It was great," I said, "for a carpenter." I nodded toward my gifts. "What am I going to do with a dowel hammer? Do they want me to start building furniture next?" Micah shook his head and sighed. "Yeah, I know what you mean, but at least you got a lot of them. I got a jigsaw. What is Mom going to make me use that for? I wanted a pair of Levi's, for God's sake." We sat in silence. "Our parents are weird, aren't they?" I asked. Micah didn't answer. When I glanced at him, I saw him staring at the jigsaw. "What?" He shook his head, his brow furrowed. "Nothing, really. It just says on the box here that this thing can cut through hardwood, like oak." "So? Isn't the hardwood in my bedroom oak?" "I think so." He pondered the situation. "And wouldn't you agree that our parents are a little heavy-handed?"
"Absolutely," I agreed.
"They're like guards at the gulag."
He blinked as if suddenly in the presence of a Martian.
"What are you talking about, Nick?"
"Never mind."
"You're weird sometimes, too."
"I know. I'd heard this before."
"But what were you saying?"
"Well, what if we use this thing to our advantage?"
"What do you mean?"
He leaned in and whispered his plan, and I had to admit he was definitely onto something. And sure enough, as soon as my parents had left for work, we were still on school break, my brother used the jigsaw to cut a hole in the closet floor that led to the crawl space beneath the house. That way, after he'd supposedly gone to bed, he could sneak out at night via his bedroom without our parents ever knowing about it. And of course, he did. It was around this time that my mom decided she was tired of working full-time and doing all the cooking and cleaning around the house. My dad was thus drafted into becoming the chef. I remember hearing about it when I got home from school one afternoon, and I honestly believe that my dad was excited about it. He told us that he was going to make one of his favorite meals, one that he used to eat when he was a kid. He forbade us from coming into the kitchen to see what he was preparing.
It's a surprise. Neither Micah, Dana, nor I knew what to make of it. The only thing our dad ever cooked on his own was chicken gizzards. Not wings, not legs or breasts, but gizzards. My dad simply loved those things. He would fry up a plateful, and while we eventually acquired a taste for them, it was obvious that gizzards wasn't on the menu that night. Frying gizzards, frying anything, made for a pleasant aroma in the kitchen. But all we could smell was something burned and scorchy, like flour that caught on fire. And more than once I heard my dad yell, "Whoops!" and race to open the back slider so the smoke could clear the kitchen. Then popping his head back into the living room, he'd say, "You guys are going to love this," or, "Cooking for you guys is going to be great. I can't wait to share more of my childhood recipes. I'm really getting the hang of it now." Eventually, after three or four whoops, he called us to the table. Mom wasn't home from work yet, and we took our seats. My dad brought the food over from the stove and set it before us. There were two items, a plate of toast, and we looked closer, but still couldn't tell. It was in a bowl, whatever it was, gray and brown and lumpy, sort of gravy-like with specks of black mixed in. The spoon was resting on the slowly solidifying mass. "I might have burned it a little, but it should be fine. Eat up." None of us moved. "What is it, Daddy?" Dana finally asked. "It's beans," he said. "I cooked them up using a secret recipe." We looked at the bowl again. It sure didn't look like beans. And it didn't smell like beans either. It smelled almost unnatural. It reminded me of something the dog ate, partially digested, then offered up again. But okay, beans and toast and... "What's for the main course?" I asked. "What do you mean? Like hamburger or chicken?" "Don't need it. Not with this meal." "What is this meal?" Micah asked. "Beans on toast," he said, his voice ringing with pride. "Your mom never made this for you, did she?" We glanced at each other, then shook our heads. My dad reached for the bowl. "Who's going to be first?" Neither Micah nor I moved a muscle. Dana finally cleared her throat.
"I will, Daddy."
He beamed. Placing a piece of toast on her plate, he started to scoop from the bowl. It was thick and hard, and my dad had to really work the spoon. The smell only got worse as it began to penetrate the substance. I saw my dad's nose wrinkle. "Like I said, I might have burned it a little," he said, "but it should be fine. Enjoy." "Are you going to eat some, Daddy?" Dana asked. "No, you three go ahead. I'll just watch. You guys are still growing and need the energy. Micah?" My dad dug into the bowl again, grimacing as he worked at the beans, as if he were trying to scoop frozen ice cream. "No, thanks. I'm supposed to be eating at Mark's tonight. I don't want to spoil my appetite." "You didn't mention that before."
"I guess I forgot, but really, I should be getting ready. I was supposed to be there 10 minutes ago."
He quickly rose from the table and vanished.
"Okay, how about you, Nick?"
"Yeah, okay," I said, raising my plate. I placed a piece of toast on it. The gravy-burned bean substance dropped like a baseball onto my plate, nearly rolling off and hitting the table.
"Just spread it out a little," my dad suggested. "It's better that way."
My sister and I began to poke at the dinner, trying to spread it but getting nowhere, terrified at the thought of actually consuming it. But just when we knew we couldn't postpone it any longer, my mom walked in the door.
"Hey, guys, how are you? It's great to see you."
She stopped and wrinkled her nose.
"What on earth is that stench?"
"It's dinner," my dad said. "Come on, we're waiting for you."
She moved to the table, took one look at the food, and said, "Kids, bring those plates to the sink."
"But," my dad said.
"No buts, I'll make spaghetti. You kids want spaghetti instead?"
We nodded eagerly and quickly rose from the table.
"Okay, just get the groceries from my baskets. I'll get going in a few minutes."
For whatever reason, my dad wasn't all that upset. In fact, I think it had been his plan all along. For after that night, he was prohibited from cooking for us. And whenever my mom complained about his failure to assume more domestic responsibility, he could honestly say, "I tried, but you wouldn't let me." Food in general became a strange sort of obsession in our home. Because we couldn't afford the same sort of treats that other kids seemed to get, cookies, Twinkies, Ho-Hos, etc., we developed a binge mentality when the opportunity presented itself. If we were visiting someone's house, for instance, we'd devour whatever we could, eating until we felt like we would burst. it was nothing for us to consume 30 or 40 Oreos in a sitting. At times, we'd leave our friends in their rooms, sneak back to the friend's kitchen, raid the pantry, and eat even more. It was the same way whenever my mom was crazy enough to buy anything sweet. Cereal, for instance. As a rule, we had only Cheerios in the house. If she happened to buy Fruit Loops or Trix on a whim, we'd eat the whole box right away. We simply couldn't fathom saving any for the following morning. Our thinking went, if I don't eat it now, the other kids will, and I deserve my fair share. We'd eat until we were sick to our stomachs. Once, after consuming 5 large bowls each of Fruit Loops in less than half an hour, Micah and I sat beside each other on the couch, bellies bloated. I think there might be enough for one last bowl, Micah said. I know, I was just thinking about that. Should we leave it for Dana? No, definitely not. She ate the last bowl last time. That's what I was thinking. But I'm so full. I can't eat another bite. We tried to get comfortable as we shifted around. Finally, Micah turned to me. Want to split it? Go half and half? Okay. My dad, too, had a sweet tooth. He always kept a stash of Oreos in the house, but knowing us, he would hide them in his office. This led us to ransack his office in search of them. Usually we'd find them after a few minutes and we'd each sneak one or two so that he wouldn't notice any were missing. We'd then go back a second and third time, always rearranging the remaining Oreos in the hope that the pack would look as if it hadn't been disturbed. By the time my dad got home from work, there'd only be a couple of broken cookies left. Holding the mostly empty bag in front of him, he'd eye the crumbs, his eyes bulging. Vultures! My kids are gee-damn vultures, he'd scream, and we'd hear him searching for his keys. Once he found them, he'd get in the car and drive to the store to buy another pack of Oreos. From his office, he'd give us the evil eye all night. The next day, the search for the bag of cookies would begin again, and once we found them, we'd eat them compulsively until only one or two broken cookies were left. Vultures, we'd hear him scream. You're all a bunch of gee-damn vultures. Chapter 10. Rarotonga, Cook Islands, January 31st. On our final morning on Easter Island, we rose early for breakfast and finished just as the sun was rising. Early mornings had become typical on our trip. Usually, breakfast began at 6:30, and we'd assemble in the lobby before 8 to start visits to the sites. It took hours to move our group anywhere. With nearly 90 people and 200 bags of luggage, we were more like a slow-moving caravan than a quick-strike task force. Departure time for the plane was usually around 10 a.m. By that time, we'd usually been up for 5 hours with little to show for it. These early mornings, late dinners, long days at the sites, and extensive travel in the previous 7 days had added up. By the end of our time on Easter Island, most everyone looked tired. Yet we were only a third of the way through the trip. The flight to Rarotonga, the main island in the cluster of South Pacific Islands known as the Cook Islands, was 7 hours. We made up some of those hours on the way west and arrived in the early afternoon. No tours were scheduled. Instead, we'd be on our own for the rest of the day and would depart for Australia in the morning. We were stopping on Rarotonga to break up the 14-hour flight between Easter Island and Ayers Rock. Rarotonga was steamy when we stepped off the plane, and far warmer than Easter Island had been. It was a typical island day, blue skies crowded with dense, puffy clouds that pretended late afternoon showers, high humidity, and a light, constant breeze. The island itself was beautiful. The main road circled the island, and central peaks were shrouded in clouds and thick with island vegetation. Like Easter Island, it had been originally settled by Polynesians, but was probably most famous because of Captain Bligh and the mutineers of the Bounty, who were marooned on the island in the late 18th century. When we arrived at the hotel, the group dispersed. Some went to lunch, others retreated to nap in their rooms. Still others went to sit on the beach or by the pool. A few decided to go snorkeling. Micah and I decided to rent scooters to explore the island. The island was roughly 25 miles in circumference, and as in England, the vehicles traveled on the opposite side of the road than they did in the States. Though it took some getting used to, the roads weren't crowded and we zipped along, stopping here and there for pictures. Palm trees stretched as far as the eye could see, and we wondered if Easter Island had once looked this way. The thought saddened us. While Easter Island had been austere and lovely in its own way, the difference between the islands was staggering.
The Cook Islands are noted for black pearls, and both Micah and I stopped to buy some for our wives. In the past week, Micah had talked to Christine twice, and I'd talked to Kat four times. None of our conversations had lasted more than a few minutes. Their lives were more hectic than usual, but their routines the same. It amazed us to think of all the places we'd been since we'd last seen them. There is something refreshing about riding with the wind in your face, and as we circled the island, my mind wandered. Part of it was that Micah and I were on our own, and without a schedule. I thought about our childhood, the places we'd lived and the things we'd done. I tried to imagine what my kids were doing, and pictured the way Kathy looked as she stood in front of the mirror in the morning. Best of all, I never thought about work as I rode, even for an instant. For the first time in years, I finally began to feel as if I were on vacation. Micah and I grabbed some bottled water and stopped at one of the public beaches on the far side of the island. The beaches were coral-strewn, and the waves just beyond the reef rose high before crashing against them. Micah and I were the only ones there, and from the beach we couldn't see any houses. With the exception of the faint sound of passing traffic on the road behind us, it would have been easy to believe we were the only ones on the island. For a long time we simply sat and watched the waves. The ocean was the color of faded turquoise, and even from our vantage point, it was possible to see through the water to the seafloor. Schools of brightly colored fish swam past us, our eyes traveling with them. Many of the South Pacific Islands have their own native species. Some fish found in Hawaii or Fiji can only be found there, and I wondered if I was seeing a species I would never see again. "Now this," Micah said, "is the reason we came to Rarotonga. Beautiful beach, beautiful weather, all by ourselves. Can it get any better?" Not exactly like our vacation to the Grand Canyon, was it? He grinned. That was some trip, wasn't it? It was great, I said. It was awful, he corrected. You're just too young to remember it the way I do. By the end, we'd driven Dad almost crazy. He'd drive all day, see a sight, and then we'd camp out in the Volkswagen at night because we couldn't afford hotels. And don't you remember we didn't have air conditioning? Here we were driving through the desert in the middle of summer, sun glaring through the windows and cooking us inside. We roasted day and night and complained all day. And we wrestled until we were slippery with sweat, screaming the whole time. Dad was pretty grouchy. Our dad? I feigned disbelief. Mr. DEFCON? You must be thinking of someone else. He laughed. I think we remember those moments about Dad so clearly because he was such a quiet guy. I barely even knew he was around half the time. And then all of a sudden, boom! Our dad isn't Dad. Suddenly he's this super scary guy. Do you remember when he brought us to the movie Alien on opening night because he heard it was the scariest movie ever made? Or when we watched Salem's Lot on television? What were we, 11 or so? Something like that. Would you let Allie see movies like that? I mean, in a couple of years? Allie, his stepdaughter, was 10 years old. There's not a chance. Christine would kill me. She wouldn't even let me bring scary videos into the house. Kathy's the same way, I sighed. Did I ever tell you that I rented Silver Bullet for Miles? No, what's that? It's this movie about werewolves. Stephen King wrote the story it was based on, and I figured that Miles might want to watch it with me. It's what our dad used to do, right? So I let him watch it. And? He had nightmares for months. Kathy was absolutely livid. I got glares you can't even imagine, and she still brings it up whenever I offer to bring Miles to a movie. He better not get nightmares, she warns. And if he does, you're the one who's going to have to sit up with him all night. Micah smiled. Our wives and children just don't seem to have the appreciation for good horror movies that we do. It's a shame, I admitted. All I wanted to do was share something with Miles that my dad shared with me growing up. Kind of like going fishing or playing catch or going to museums. I understand completely, little brother, he said. He put his arm around me. You gotta give that to Dad, he said. He did teach us to appreciate the important things in life. Once back at the hotel, we decided to go snorkeling. While I've snorkeled in the Caribbean and Hawaii, I've never been more impressed than I was that day. Thousands of bright blue starfish, barracudas, and colorful reef fish swam in the warm, clear water. And a light current made it possible to float at the surface of the shallow water while expending little effort. Above us, clouds had filled in the sky, making it possible for us to be out without getting sunburned, and we stayed in the water even when the rain started to fall. Afterward, we ate at the hotel's outdoor patio. We
We were trying to decide what to do later in the evening. With nothing planned, it seemed like a waste to head back to our rooms. The bartender, who was also our waiter, recommended a pub crawl and said a van would stop by the hotel around 8 o'clock if we signed up for it. A pub crawl is essentially that. The van comes by, picks you up, and brings you from one pub to the next over the course of the evening. Whether or not a person drinks, however, is almost beside the point. Over the years, I've visited numerous countries, and I've learned that until you meet the people in a relaxed setting, doing what they normally do, you haven't actually experienced what the country is all about. Almost everyone I've ever met in situations like that is friendly. Most people around the world enjoy practicing their English and hearing about America. Our country, warts and all, is a place that foreigners find both fascinating and intriguing. They love some things and hate others, but everyone has an opinion about it. At the same time, I'm always struck by how similar people are, no matter where they live. Throughout the world, people not only want to have the chance to improve their own situation, but want their children to have more opportunities than they have. Politicians are nearly always held in low esteem. So are demagogues on both the right and the left. Our bartender was no different, and though he was mildly disappointed that we wouldn't be traveling to New Zealand, his home country, he did add that he'd visited the United States.
"Oh yeah," Micah said. "Where?"
"I was in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Las Vegas, Denver, Dallas, New Orleans, Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and New York. I spent a summer traveling around the country."
"Did you see the Grand Canyon?" Micah asked.
"Yes, of course," he said. "I thought it was great. Mount Rushmore, too. And the giant redwoods. Beautiful. My favorite place was Las Vegas."
"Did you win in Vegas?" I asked.
"No. I lost. I played the slots, you know. But it was fun. That's the wildest city. I love it there. Have you ever been there?"
"Of course," Micah said. "From Sacramento is just over an hour away by plane." The bartender shook his head, a look of pleasure on his face.
"I tell people, if you want to see America, go to Vegas. The lights, the shows, the excitement, it's America."
While we were eating, Jill Hanna, the physician, joined us. Over the past few days, she'd been busy since so many people were developing stomach problems. Like everyone, she seemed lethargic, and when we mentioned we were going out that night, she raised her eyebrows.
"Aren't you guys tired?"
"A little," Micah answered, "but you should come too, it'll be fun."
"Thanks, but I'm going to bed."
"Is anyone else going with you?"
"We'll see," Micah said. "We're going to ask around in a little while."
Not surprisingly, most everyone we asked said no, no matter how fun we tried to make it sound. We must have spoken to a couple of dozen people, but only Charles, one of the lecturers on the tour, said he'd come. We told him that we'd meet him in the lobby at 8.
"We're just going to take a short nap," Micah said, "and we'll see you then."
We headed back to our room, lay down, and fell fast asleep, neither of us waking until the following morning. At breakfast, Charles came over to our table.
"Where were you guys last night? I was waiting for you. I was all set to have a great time."
"Sorry about that," Micah said sheepishly.
"I can't believe the brothers Sparks actually got tired."
"Sometimes," Micah said, "it happens to the best of us." As soon as Charles left, I leaned toward Micah. "I can't believe we slept through it. I guess we're getting older, huh?"
"I know what you mean. In college, it seemed like I never got tired. I could go out all night long. I was wild."
"College?" I asked. "Who are you kidding? You were wild in high school." In 1979, Micah began high school, and for the next 2 years, my brother had a tenuous relationship with everyone in the family. He'd reached the age where he began to openly question my parents' authority and acted out accordingly. Yet Micah, as probably could have been expected, was more, even when it came to being a teenager. He got drunk at the river, and my mom once found marijuana in the pocket of his jeans and grounded him for a month after threatening him with military school. At 15, Micah also came home with a pierced ear. My mom made him remove the earring by issuing yet another threat about military school. She always threatened us with military school. Both of our parents had gone to boarding school, and each of them had shared their horror stories, always ending with, "But at least it wasn't military school." As kids, we were terrified at the thought of these institutions, believing they'd been designed by Satan himself. But Micah was listening to our parents less and less, and he'd come to realize that he'd never actually be sent away, if only because the family couldn't afford it. Thus, his behavior got worse and worse. During his freshman year, the mood in the house was extremely tense, and my sister and I were often amazed at the way he boldly raised his voice to our mom and dad. Image is important to most teenagers, and Micah was no exception. He was tired of being poor, and even worse, looking poor.